Israel's sternest critics, Israel's harshest critics, they agreed with Israel on one point. They conceded one point. They said it is true that Israel does have the right to prevent weapons from reaching Gaza. It does have the right to prevent weapons from reaching Gaza. But that's not altogether obvious. If a people living under occupation have the right to use armed force to eject an occupier, then as the letter B follows the letter A, they must have the right to receive weapons to enable them to use armed force to eject a foreign occupier. Some of you at this point might feel uncomfortable with that sort of language. We didn't come here to hear about force, murder, death, war. We came here because we're interested in peace and in a nonviolent resolution of the conflict. And I can be sympathetic to that. I can understand that. But if that's your point of view, the position of the organizations which conceded Israel's right to block weapons, their position was still hypocritical. Why? Well, after the attack on Gaza, Amnesty International issued a report entitled Fueling Conflict. And they said, under international law, it's illegal to transfer weapons to a country or a non-state actor that is a consistent violator of human rights. So Amnesty said, yes, Hamas is a consistent violator of human rights, but so is Israel a consistent violator of human rights. So under international law, said Amnesty, there has to be a comprehensive total arms embargo on Hamas and Israel. It's fair enough to say that Israel had the right to prevent weapons from reaching Gaza if you also say that we have an obligation to prevent weapons from reaching Israel. That's not rhetoric. That's the law. It also happens to be, as Amnesty International pointed out, it also happens to be domestic American law. On May 31st, another in a long sequence of attempts or series of attempts to break the blockade of Gaza unfolded as the Freedom Flotilla headed towards Gaza. We'll never quite know what happened on that fateful morning of May 31st, beginning at 4:30 a.m. But the basic picture is pretty clear now. The Human Rights Council of the UN, it mandated a commission to investigate what happened. I will not make any brief for the Human Rights Council. I think it is undeserving of respect, but it happens to be the case that the commissions they've mandated have consisted of respected international jurists, whether it was the case of the Goldstone mission or the mission that investigated what happened on the flagship vessel of the Freedom Flotilla, the Mavi Marmara. Time doesn't allow me to go into the details, but the basic picture as they presented it goes something like this. Israel began the assault on the Mavi Marmara with its zodiacs, its inflatable boats, approaching the Mavi Marmara using stun grenades, tear gas, and perhaps plastic bullets. After that initial attack was repelled, according to the report, about 5 minutes later, the Israeli helicopters came in, and the report is very clear that Israel began to use live ammunition targeting the deck of the Mavi Marmara before any Israeli commando hit the deck of the Mavi Marmara. Live ammunition was used. By the end of the melee, 9 passengers aboard the Mavi Marmara were dead. 6 of the 9, according to the mission, 6 of the 9 died as a result of what they called summary execution, which is to say they were murdered in cold blood. Even if we don't know, and perhaps we'll never know definitively, what happened in those hours in the Mavi Marmara, from a legal point of view, it's completely irrelevant. The basic facts are not controversial. Number one, Israel had imposed an illegal blockade on Gaza, a form of collective punishment which is prohibited under the Geneva Convention. Number two, Israel was causing a humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Number three, Israel never made any claim or pretense that it was trying to prevent weapons from going to Gaza. It showed no interest in searching the flotilla's cargo, although it was invited to, and it didn't pretend that the boats were transporting weapons in Gaza, to Gaza. And now there's a basic principle of law, which it does not require a degree from UBC to understand. And the principle is, you can't get a right from a wrong. If your initial act is wrong, as in you're imposing an illegal blockade, then you can't have the right to enforce, or I should say, you can't have the right to use force in order to enforce what's illegal in the first place. If the blockade is illegal and there has been no dispute and no controversy that the blockade is illegal, then you had no right to use force in order to enforce what was illegal to begin with. You can't get a right from a wrong. There is, however, an interesting question. Let's for argument's sake agree that Israel did have the right to block the Freedom Flotilla from reaching Gaza. For argument's sake, there's still an interesting question. Why did Israel resort to force? They had many nonviolent options, as the Israelis themselves said. They could have disabled the propeller on the boat. They could have disabled the rudder on the boat. They could have disabled the engine on the boat and then just towed the boat to an Israeli port. Israel has a formidable navy. They could have physically blocked the boats from going to Gaza. Even on Israel's own terms, let's look at what Israel itself said. On its own terms, the use of armed force made no sense. as virtually everyone in this room will remember, the day after the attack on the Mavi Marmara, Israel kept saying in its defense, we didn't expect violent resistance. We didn't expect they would use force against us. We thought that we would just land on the boat and we would have, to use their word, a conversation with the nonviolent resistors on the deck. We were shocked that they resorted to force. How many people remember that? Raise your hand. Okay. But then an obvious question comes to mind. If Israel didn't expect force to be used against it, then why didn't it board the boat in broad daylight? Why did it launch the attack at 4:30 a.m.? Why did it launch the attack using stun grenades and tear gas and maybe plastic bullets? If they didn't expect any resistance, they could have just boarded the boats in broad daylight and even brought along many journalists to show the world their peaceful intentions. If Israel didn't expect violence or intend violence, why did it deploy a commando unit trained to kill and not a police unit accustomed to handling civil resistors? The reasonable inference is that Israel wanted a bloody confrontation, although almost certainly not on the scale that ensued after the Israeli commandos panicked at the passengers' determined resistance, and then the commandos exacted more deaths. That's basically what happened, as far as we can tell so far. But the more fraught political question is where we're headed. Because as I said at the beginning of my remarks, Israel has now suffered a succession of military defeats, bungled commando operations, and the Mavi Marmara was really the climax of all of these disasters for Israel. After the Mavi Marmara, the Israeli commentators said, it was a disgraceful fiasco, a national humiliation. Our deterrence took a bad blow. It wasn't a fiasco because 9 passengers were killed. That's just an irrelevance. It was a disaster because of how the commandos, the Israeli commandos, acquitted themselves. It happens that those naval commandos, which rappelled onto the deck of the Mavi Marmara, they're Israel's best fighting unit. They are the equivalent of the American Naval SEALs. They are Israel's elite fighting force, the creme de la creme of the Israeli Defense Forces. I don't think Canada has an equivalent of the Naval SEALs, though I'm sure Mr. Harper and Mr. Kenny are staying up nights trying to figure out how to create an equivalent. And actually, personally, I wouldn't mind if Mr. Harper enlists in his own Naval SEALs, so long as he's not given an oxygen tank. I mean, that's American humor. Canadians are too civilized to appreciate that. Well, it happens that there were 30 Israeli Naval SEALs that rappelled onto the deck of the Mavi Marmara. And by coincidence, they faced off almost in exactly the same number of Turkish civilian passengers who had only makeshift weapons. 30 against 30, and before you knew it, three of the Israelis had been captured. Israel's elite unit. A former US Marine who had been involved in the capture of two of the three commandos. He later said, "They looked like frightened children in the face of an abusive father. They looked like frightened children in the face of an abusive father." Well, you may laugh, but Israel is surely not laughing. That's not the image they want to project to their foe or their friend of the Israeli army. One Israeli general said, "It's one thing for people to think we're crazy, that's okay. But it's bad when they think we're incompetent and crazy." And that may sound funny as well, but it has very ominous implications, because Israel is now more desperate than ever to restore its deterrence capacity. The Arab world's fear of it. It needs to do so because of a succession of military defeats, bungled commando operations, and then this growing coalition, now seeming to include this character, Mr. Erdogan from Turkey. Where did Turkey come from? That was supposed to be Israel's main ally in the Muslim world. And now this character, Erdogan, he's got this weird idea that Turkey is important. He goes to this Davos summit, and in the public, he starts telling the Israeli president, Shimon Peres, that the Israeli army is filled with killers. Then he joins forces with the head of state of Brazil to try to achieve a diplomatic resolution of the problems with Iran. These Arabs, these Muslims, they're getting just too big for their britches. It's time to cut them down to size. And judging by the most recent reports, knowledgeable reports, the place Israel intends to do so is once again in Lebanon. The former U.S. ambassador to Israel, Daniel Kurtzer, he recently authored a study, and he said that Israel will likely attack Lebanon in the next 12 to 18 months. He said, or Israel has said, that it will do to Lebanon what it did to Gaza in 2008-9. Are there any folks in this room from Lebanon? Raise your hand. Just a few. For those of you from Lebanon, you'll know the area, the south suburb of Beirut, called the Dahia. The Dahia is populated mostly by poor Shia civilians supportive of Hezbollah. And during the 2006 war, Israel turned the Dahia into a parking lot. There was nothing left there except for the craters in the ground. Israel was very pleased with what it had accomplished in Lebanon, or I should say in the Dahia, so much so that they coined a new term. It's called the Dahia Doctrine. And basically it means using massive force against civilians and civilian infrastructure. They first tested the Dahia Doctrine in Gaza, but they've said they intend to do it again in the next war. On one point, Israel and its chief nemesis, Hezbollah, agree. Israel says the next war, and now I'm quoting it, will be game-changing. The head of Hezbollah, Saeed Nasrallah, he says the next war will change the face of this region. Mr. Nasrallah has said in a series of speeches this past year, over and over again, he said, the next war will be a tit-for-tat war. An airport for an airport, a port for a port, a city for a city, a building for a building, a power station for a power station, a factory for a factory. Now, whether you like Mr. Nasrallah or not, we can all agree that his entire reputation, and he knows it, rests on the fact that there's an exact correspondence between his words and his deeds. That is, there's every reason to suppose that Nasrallah means what he says and will, in fact, must do what he promises. And then you have to ask yourself, what will Israel do if Hezbollah missiles start targeting Tel Aviv and massive civilian casualties begin to accumulate? The prospect grows yet more terrifying when you bear in mind that, true, everything I've said so far is speculative, and I'm the first one to concede it, and I'm the first one to say, I surely hope I'm wrong. But there's one point which is not speculative. There is no possible way Israel will accept another defeat in Lebanon. That is impossible. If it appears as if a defeat is impending, then Israel will do what it has to do to make sure it will not be defeated. And I do not believe at that point even the U.S. can stop it. On the other hand, I do not believe that if it appears as if a Hezbollah defeat is impending, I do not believe Iran will sit by quietly. Not because of any sense of solidarity, but because of self-interest. Because Iran knows if Hezbollah is defeated, that they're the next ones in line. In 2006, it was perfectly understood by everyone that the attack on Lebanon by Israel was a prelude to the attack on Iran. As it happened, Iran didn't have to enter the picture because Hezbollah won. But this time, if it looks as if Hezbollah is losing, Iran will for certain, or not for certain, but quite likely, will enter. In short, an Israeli attack on Hezbollah would trigger a chain reaction, the outcome of which, as I said, no sane person would want to contemplate. So where do we stand now? The blockade of Gaza continues. Israel still makes it nearly impossible for construction and building material to enter Gaza. According to the United Nations, at the present rate, it would take 75 years to bring in the materials needed to rebuild Gaza. Israel also prohibits exports from Gaza, making it nearly impossible to restore Gaza's economy. Oxfam, the human rights humanitarian organization, it said, what Gaza needs now most are jobs, raw materials for reconstruction and for industry, and the ability to export, not just short-term aid and consumer products like jam that without a job, Gazans can't afford. Nonetheless, we would be short-sighted, we would be remiss if we in any way underrated the significance of the achievement of the people in the Mavi Marmara. the Nonviolent International Grassroots Initiative. It proved able to force the hand of the world's mightiest powers. That last phase of the blockade of Gaza.